If things evolve broadly in line with the outlook that we published today, we will be becoming more confident that we're clearly on a path to 2% inflation, and it will be appropriate to cut our interest rate.
We're not there yet. That was Bank of Canada Governor Tiff Macklem earlier today, the latest rate policy announcement from the bank. And maybe not a big surprise. I don't think anyone was expecting any rate cuts today, or for that matter, any rate increases. The Bank of Canada again holding the line at 5%. But at the same time saying that we're seeing things going in the right direction. And so long as things continue to go in the right direction, we could see some rate cuts later this year. Maybe June. Certainly it sounds like not before that. So if you were looking for some further clarity on when rates come down, you got a bit of that today. But we're not at the finish line yet. And, you know, we see the inflation numbers in the U.S., which interestingly almost now seem to be going in the wrong direction. You know, just speaks to how challenging it is to tame high inflation. So joining us to talk more about all of this, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Steve Ambler, professor of economics, University of Quebec at Montreal, and serves as David Dodge, chair in monetary policy of the CD Howe Institute. Professor Ambler, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Rob. Very happy to be with you.
So I think in terms of maybe what we're expecting today, no big surprises?
Oh, not at all. I think markets were predicting about a 5% chance of a cut at best. Mm-hmm. So there were, that's exactly what happened. No change.
Yeah. Some expectation there. Everyone's sort of looking for some clues or some signals as to where things are going. So what did you read into the governor's comments there?
Oh, I think they're signaling that rate cuts are going to be coming pretty soon. In fact, if you listen to the whole press conference, there was a reporter that asked the question directly, are you going to be open to a rate cut in June? And Governor Macklem sort of said, well, and then after humming and hawing, he said, yes. So I would actually be predicting the first rate cut to come in June. I think in your introduction you said something about not before then, but the bank never makes, except in emergency circumstances, they will never make a rate change between their fixed announcement date.
Right. Yeah, that's when the next scheduled announcement is. So it is interesting because there's a bit of a gap there. We're actually going to get, as I understand, two cycles of data on inflation from Stats Can between now and then. So that'll give us a really good indication, I think, of where things are at.
The February inflation numbers are out, so we should be getting March and April before the next announcement, and then the May numbers will come out maybe a week after the announcement.
So the indicators that the Bank of Canada is watching, and, you know, the governor's saying today that what matters to them, the indicators that matter, are going in the right direction, but they just want to make sure that these are lasting trends. Are you seeing the same thing? Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, we've seen a couple of instances in the last 6 months where, you know, inflation has been coming down, but then it sort of briefly ticked back up again by 0.2 or 0.3 percentage points. So I think the bank is, at this point, doesn't want to overpromise and underdeliver. In terms of promising a rate cut and then having to backtrack, I think the biggest danger at this point is going to be coming from energy, from oil and gasoline costs. And my own opinion is that even if gasoline prices spike and that leads to a bit of a tick up in inflation, the bank should ignore that because there's nothing they can do about it anyway.
I mentioned, you know, the situation in the U.S. where the economy has been certainly, I think, much more robust than Canada's has. But, you know, just when things seem to be trending in the right direction, you've seen a bit of a fallback. Inflation has ticked up in the United States. Is it different circumstances there, or is it a bit of a warning or word of caution to Canada that, you know, until we're at the finish line, you know, the job's really not done?
Yes, I think so. I mean, as you said, the American economy is chugging along at a much faster pace than ours is. Unemployment is much lower. And in fact, Canadian unemployment ticked up last month from 5.8 to 6.1%. So the labor market in Canada is showing signs of weakness. And also, their inflation rate ticked up. Ours seems to be trending down. And as it does, with a bank rate of 5%, If you take 5% minus the inflation rate, that's the real interest rate. Monetary policy is actually getting more and more restrictive over time, even with the same 5% policy rate. So that's why I think it would be advisable to start cutting in June, just so that real interest rates, and that's the same thing goes for people who are looking at borrowing now. All interest rates are influenced by the bank's policy rate, so that that means real interest rates right across the economy are going up. And that's going to make people hesitant, firms hesitant to invest, households hesitant to plunge into the housing market, and so forth.
Right. So in your view, then, is June the right time to cut rates? You know, the bank's been cautious. I've heard some wondering whether, you know, that they might delay a rate cut till later in the year. But does June seem right to you?
Yeah, I mean, I would have personally advised them to cut this time. And I think it's getting to the point where, as I said, real interest rates are creeping up as they keep it at 5%. And if they hold on much longer, I mean, a lot of people say that we have now achieved the so-called proverbial soft landing, where we will have managed to beat inflation without suffering a major recession.
Yeah.
But if the bank stays at 5% for too long, that could happen. As I said, the labor market is looking increasingly weak. And growth, that actually the bank revised upwards its prediction of GDP growth this year. But a lot of that is coming from an increase in the labor force because of immigration. In fact, the labor force and the population is growing faster than GDP, which actually means the GDP per capita has been, and I think will continue to go down, which means we're actually getting poorer.
Well, yeah, I mean, that speaks to some of the underlying weakness in the economy right now, which maybe makes it easier for the bank to cut rates.
Easier for them to cut and dangerous for them not to cut.
Yeah. But in terms of the size of a cut, and I would imagine they're going to be cautious with this too. I don't think anyone's under any illusions. We're not going back to the low rates that we've seen over the last, you know, decade or so, or even going, you know, 10 or 15 years. Like, we're not going back to, you know, 1 to 2%. But what's reasonable to expect this year, do you think?
Well, I don't think they're going to cut by anything more than 25 basis points at a given announcement. They only do that in basically emergency situations, such as when they first started to hike rates in 2022, after they really fell behind the curve and inflation really took off. I think we did see a couple of 50 basis point increases.
Right.
But, I mean, unless something disastrous were to happen, they're not going to cut by more than 25 basis points at a time. So it's going to take probably three or four cuts, four cuts to get back to 4%. They also revised upwards what they call the neutral interest rate in the monetary policy report by 25 basis points. So I would say that in the long term, maybe by sometime next year, we'll be able to get back down to maybe 3%. But I don't think rates are going to go lower than that.
We'll see where things go between now and June. We'll get a couple of cycles of inflation data, as mentioned, and June is when the next rate policy announcement is scheduled. All eyes on that announcement in terms of possible rate cuts. Much more at cdhal.org. Steve, appreciate the insight. Thanks so much for joining us here this afternoon.
Great pleasure. Thanks very much.
All the best.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
Steve Ambler, professor of economics, University of Quebec at Montreal, serves as David Don's chair in monetary policy at the CD Howe Institute. Yeah, I guess if he had his druthers, you know, he would have seen a rate cut today. And I think there are others who share that view, that the bank could be cutting rates now. They're taking a more cautious approach. So not yet, but a lot of signs pointing to a possible rate cut in June. Not a significant cut. As Steve says, we're likely to be seeing rate cuts once we get there in the realm of, you know, 25 basis points. So maybe from 5 to 4.75. All goes well down to 4.5. And so that would get us, you know, maybe closer to 4% by the end of the year, if all goes well. So we'll see. But that's where things stand today in the latest from the Bank of Canada. We can talk more about some of those issues, affordability concerns. Should the bank be more aggressive right now in cutting rates? I think it was Ontario's premier last week who was basically imploring the bank, start cutting rates. These higher interest rates, these mortgage renewals, that's having a big impact on Canadian households. Welcome back. Welcome to this hour of the program. Rob Breckenridge with you here on an eventful Wednesday afternoon, including as we speak, the Prime Minister on the stand of the public inquiry into foreign election interference. We'll keep one eye on that and see if anything of note comes from that testimony. A few other things we'll get to in this hour, some time for your phone calls as well. Off the top in this hour, though, a conversation around an issue that remains top of mind for Canadians. Consistently, when Canadians are asked what issues matter the most to them, healthcare remains at or near the top of the list. And despite the deals reached last year between the federal government and provinces for additional healthcare support, there's real concern, I think, when it comes to the healthcare system, access to healthcare. Whether that's wait times for surgery, wait times in emergency room, so being able to find a family doctor. All of these remain issues here in Alberta, and I would argue remain issues in most of the country. So why is healthcare so difficult to fix? Is it fixable? Well, all of this is explored in a new book by someone who has seen it from the inside, both as a doctor and as a federal minister of health. Dr. Jane Philpott is the author of a new book. It's called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. And also to let you know that Dr. Philpott is going to be in our city this week, an event happening tomorrow night and another event happening Friday morning. More details at wordfest.com. But joining us on the line is the aforementioned Dr. Jane Philpott. Dr. Philpott, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So how would you describe then the challenges or the problems plaguing Canadian healthcare right now?
Well, the situation right now is about as bad as I've seen it in 40 years since I've been in the healthcare business. And it's particularly affecting the front lines of care. So I'm a family doctor, and we now know that there are about 7 million people in the country that either don't have a family doctor, nor do they have any other way to get into the healthcare system with a primary care provider. And that is causing enormous pressures on the system. And it's also meaning, of course, for all those people that nobody's taking care of them and doing the prevention that's needed, nor there for them when they're sick and they have no place to go but to the emergency department.
So why is this still an issue? I mean, you know, we spend a lot of money on healthcare in this country, and it's funding that's going up every year, certainly in terms of Ottawa's contribution. So why aren't we seeing value for those dollars?
It's a fantastic question. And, you know, the reality is that the things that we spend money on the most are the most expensive parts of the system. So we spend most of our money on hospitals and on physician care and on medication. But where we're not spending enough money or focusing our attention is on primary care. And so that's why my book proposes that that's where we need to be focusing and ensure that every single person in this country has a primary care provider, ideally what we call a primary care home, a team of interdisciplinary providers who can give them the care that they need so that we don't have the expensive forms of care required later on.
Yeah, and I mean, that's been a big focus here in Alberta, as you probably know. You know, how do we attract and retain family doctors? How do we ensure that they feel respected and appreciated? There's a lot of Albertans who don't have access to a family doctor, and I think that's the reality for a lot of Canadians.
Exactly. Well, it's a problem across the country, and everyone's grappling with how to fix it. And I know in Alberta, for example, you've got medical school expansion happening, which is all great news. So there's certainly some activity going in that regard. But I think what we're missing is a commitment on the part of governments, whether it's the federal government or the provincial governments, to say, you know what, it is about time that Canada does what many other countries do, particularly ones in Europe, and they make sure that in every neighborhood there is a primary care home. You know, we make sure in this country that every child has a school to go to. We would think it was awful if we thought that it was good enough if only 80% of our kids had access to a public school. But we've allowed that to happen in healthcare, where we somehow are not doing anything about the fact that only 78% of people in Canada have a place to go for primary care. So it's about time that's what we focus on, and it will have a ripple effect across the rest of the system.
So what did you learn or take away from your time as federal health minister when it came to the difficulties or the challenges in fixing these problems?
Well, it was actually very helpful to be on the inside of government to see how challenging it is, but also to see how it can sometimes work really well. And one of the things that's really important, of course, is when governments work together. So some of the work that we did when I was in government that was most effective and legislation that we were able to pass effectively happened when the federal government and the provinces sat down together, weren't arguing with each other all the time, and actually said, what do the people of Canada need and how can we work together to make it happen? So here's where we're really challenged in the current climate is we're not seeing that kind of collaboration between the federal government and the provinces. And on healthcare, which, as you said, matters so much to Canadians, we need to get our politicians to come together and agree how this is a shared jurisdiction, therefore a shared responsibility, and they should be able to work it out for the benefit of the well-being of Canadians.
Talk about why it matters. If Canadians all have access to primary care, or better access to primary care, how does that affect the rest of the system?
Well, as I said, it's what we would call upstream care. It's sort of trying to, first of all, promote health in the first place and make sure that people are using healthy habits and practices, but then also providing that preventative care that they need, making sure that they're screened for cancer so that we can detect it as early as possible, making sure that if they have diabetes or high blood pressure that someone is monitoring that, because what happens if they don't have that, they are literally showing up in our emergency departments with stage 4 cancer, which at that point is incurable, and it could have been prevented. And I think that's just unconscionable that in this country, we're not doing something to make sure that everyone has access to that upstream care that is much more affordable and, of course, can help to save lives.
So the challenges are many. I mean, you know, first of all, there's just having enough doctors. I don't know if there are enough doctors in Canada presently that could guarantee every Canadian has access to one. So is it about attracting more doctors, training more doctors? Are there insufficient resources going into this? Like, how do we go about fixing this?
Well, like any complex problem, there are multiple factors that go into it, but you're absolutely right. The workforce issues are a big part of it. We definitely don't have enough family doctors, and part of the challenge that we're facing in the country is that fewer and fewer of our medical students are choosing family medicine because they look at how hard it is. They look at the burnout rates and the fact that there's so much administrative burden on our family physicians. So, as I said, in Alberta and elsewhere, medical schools are expanding and new medical school campuses are opening up, which is great news. But we need to make sure that we don't just train a lot more doctors and they all become specialists outside of family medicine. So we're doing work in the medical schools in the country to try to make family medicine more appealing. But medical schools can't do the job alone. We need governments to actually address the conditions of work and to be able to establish a proactive system so that doctors will have the support that they need. We don't expect teachers to graduate from teachers' college and then, you know, go out and rent a building to start a school buy the desks and chairs and computers that are needed. We have systems in place to do all of that, but we have never done the same for primary care where we've actually organized ourselves and ensured that when there's a neighborhood that's growing, that we not only make sure a new school gets put in that neighborhood, but that a primary care home gets put in as well.
So that almost sounds like, you know, nationalizing primary care where, you know, in Alberta, family doctors are basically private businesses that contract with the system or build the system. Are you talking about a system where family physicians, primary care physicians kind of work for the healthcare system?
Well, there are multiple ways that you can do it. And as I said, you know, the UK has a national health service. Many countries in Europe have 95 to 99% access to family medicine. And they've done it in different ways. You know, sometimes they have continued to allow those physicians to be private practitioners. And sometimes it's done in a more nationalized way. And, you know, we're actually seeing openness now amongst young physicians who are saying, actually, I would give up a bit of the autonomy I have now if someone would actually step in and help me organize the small business side of this. Because what I'd really like to do and what I've trained for is to provide clinical care for patients. And so, how this actually rolls out specifically in each province will probably be slightly different, but it starts with hearing our government say right from the very top of our federal and provincial governments to say, we're going to make a commitment. I argue that the federal government should pass a a law that says that we are making a commitment as a country that every person will have a right to primary care, work with the provinces to see what that looks like as it's rolled out, but give people an assurance that there's an accountability in the system, that they will have a place to go to get that care.
And I mean, is it okay in your view that provinces take different approaches? Like, I don't think anyone has an appetite for, you know, a huge constitutional fight where Ottawa just decides to take over jurisdiction for healthcare. I don't think that's ever going to happen. And so it remains where provinces do have this jurisdiction. We have different provincial governments with different views on how this should be done.
And absolutely, there's a lot of room within our system for provinces to operationalize things in their own way. Health is a shared jurisdiction, and when we've done big things together on health, like the Canada Health Act that has served us pretty well over the last 40 years, we've done it because we've seen the federal government say, we're going to actually set some standards, we're going to pass money on to the provinces, and we're going to ask them to deliver according to these standards to make sure, for example, that people will get the care they need based on their medical condition. It's time to have some standards associated with primary care. They don't exist at the moment. The federal government can set those standards. They can work in a collaborative, consensus-building way with the provinces to decide what the standards are and make sure that they put in some resources which the provinces can then operationalize in their own way. Not exactly like one another, but the Canadians will know everyone has a primary care home, a team where they can go and get that integrated first-person care.
So someone who has seen, you know, the inner workings of government and has a good understanding of what's doable and what's practical and what isn't, where does this rank in your view?
I think this is completely doable, and not just because it's the right thing to do, but because we've seen it work elsewhere. And we've seen these countries in Europe that get better health outcomes and they actually pay less per capita for health than we do. So I see this as highly doable. Really, the thing that's holding us back is the political will of leaders in all orders of government who need to be listening to what Canadians are concerned about. And this is something that many Canadians are very worried about all across the country.
Well, the book is out now. It's called Health for All, A Doctor's Prescription for a Healthier Canada. As mentioned, you're going to be here in Calgary for two events. Tomorrow night at the Memorial Park Library, Friday morning, also at the Memorial Park Library. More details, ticket information, wordfest.com. Dr. Jane Philpott, thanks again for joining us here today. Really do appreciate this.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
All the best. Take care. That is Dr. Jane Philpott, a family physician, author of the book Health for All, and of course, former federal health minister, which she sees as some of the big challenges facing our healthcare system right now and how we go about fixing them. We haven't heard a lot lately about the federal government's proposed ban on so-called assault-style weapons and some of the various components to that. But the issue hasn't gone away. A few weeks ago, the National Post reported that the government has already spent $42 million on a firearms buyback program that doesn't even exist yet. In response to an order paper filed by Senator Don Platt, Public Safety Canada revealed that $41.9 million has been spent so far on the government's firearms buyback program, and that 60 department employees are working on the project. The senator asked in Senate question period of the government, how can you have spent $42 million on this when not a single firearm has been bought back? Very good question. This is proving to be very difficult. I mean, initially, the government said that this buyback program would cost somewhere between $400 and $600 million. It's at least now going to be $2 billion. And then there's the whole mechanism of this. How exactly is this all going to work? How is all of this going to be done? So did the government really know what it was getting into? Why is this proving to be so difficult? Now, the Canadian Sporting Arms and Ammunition Association was enlisted here to represent retailers in all of this to help them navigate this whole situation. So they've got a close look at how things are playing out here. Joining us on the line is Wes Winkle, who is president of the Canadian Sporting Arms and Ammunition Association. Their website at csaaa.org. Wes, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Tell us a bit more, first of all, before we get into this, just, you know, the role that your organization is playing in all of this.
Yeah, so our organization represents the firearms business's interests, not just in this confiscation initiative, but also in all government relations We represent manufacturers, distributors, and retailers throughout Canada.
So where are things at right now as far as this buyback program is concerned?
Yeah, so just to clarify, our organization is only dealing with the business purchase buybacks.
Right.
We're not dealing with any with the individual. We're only dealing with the ones that come from businesses.
But is that going to work differently? Sorry.
Yes, sorry. It probably will work differently just because the individual one's much more convoluted.
Sure.
Whereas the government doesn't necessarily know where all those firearms are. A lot of those firearms are still what they call non-restricted, so they're not registered inside Canada in individuals' hands. But at the businesses, they're all recorded in business ledgers, and it's a little bit more in the open of what the business has currently in their inventory.
Okay, so theoretically, on paper, that would be easier, but has any of that happened yet? Where are things at there?
It hasn't happened yet, and it is easier, I think, for the business aspect than it is for the individual by a long shot. However, it's still proving to be quite convoluted. The one thing that I think that Minister Blair, when they did this knee-jerk prohibition, was that Minister Blair wasn't aware of how modular these firearms are. These firearms are rarely sold fully assembled. There's a lot of different parts, and they're kind of like the Mr. Potato Head of firearms. And therefore, there's a lot of components to them, and there's a lot of partially assembled or completely modular builds. So it proves to be a lot more difficult to try to catalog when you're trying to figure out, what actually these retailers have in their inventory.
Right. And so how would the compensation work then?
Well, it proved to be quite challenging because the only really way is to build a catalog of all the components as well as the assembled firearms. And of course, when you're building a catalog of all the different parts that go with it, it definitely proves to be a little more of a process. But the government did hear the concerns of the industry that we need those components to be compensated for as well, because with the prohibition process, they've proved to be quite useless. Because many of these parts only fit the category of firearms that are currently prohibited.
Right. And I mean, do at least have some clarity at this point as to what is prohibited and what's going to fall under this?
There's more clarity than there was. It's still not completely finished. The one big issue that we have is that the firearms prohibition that happened by Oregon Council banned a style of firearm, and that's very arbitrary.
Yeah.
So, there's still firearms being added as we speak to the list. The initial list started at 1,500, and that's what the government keeps talking about. However, it's expanded greatly from that initial date that the prohibition was announced, as they found that more guns are of that style. Again, there's no real mechanical definition, so we're only going by an arbitrary, depending on what the firearm looks like. It's nothing to do with whether it's got a higher rate of fire or more powerful. It's done by look and appearance, and that makes it very difficult to figure out what's prohibited and what's not.
And when you talk about retailers, I think people are envisioning, like gun shops, basically retailers that specialize in firearms, but that's not the entire landscape. I mean, there are bigger retailers out there. I mean, Cabela's would be one example, right, of a retailer that does sell firearms, but that's not their specialty. So what kind of challenges does it pose for those kinds of businesses?
Well, I mean, yes, there's a lot of challenges. I mean, you have the Cabela's and the Bass Pros and the Canadian Tires, which, of course, are larger chains.
Yeah.
And a lot of those businesses don't have necessarily firearms experts on staff. And therefore, it's a little more difficult for them to identify what firearms are first of all, prohibited. And then secondly, what firearms are eligible for compensation inside this program. A lot of these businesses have these firearms because, of course, there were hunting rifles included in the prohibition, and it makes it quite difficult for them to figure out what's covered and what's not. Further complicating the process was an announced possible prohibition by last fall in Bill C-21 that ended up being canceled before the bill passed, and there was a lot of firearms included in that prohibition that didn't end up being included in the law, and therefore some people think those are still included. So
Wow. It's
very convoluted and difficult to navigate.
And then we've got this uncertainty because we're in this period now where there's an amnesty in place. That's been extended a couple of times. So the latest was to October of next year. So what would happen if we get to that point and if retailers still haven't, unloaded these firearms that they're in possession of? What kind of a position would they be in without an amnesty?
Well, the amnesty is what the firearms are currently prohibited, and the only thing that protects them from being inside the business inventories is the amnesty. So if the amnesty's expired and they haven't been dealt with, then the businesses would be in illegal possession of those firearms, and they could put themselves not only in liability of losing their business license, but also criminal liability for being in that possession. So it's very important that these firearms get dealt with before the expiration of the amnesty.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you know, as I think you've alluded to already, maybe the government didn't fully realize the challenges here, what they were getting into.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's quite a disconnect between the original. I mean, there's been a couple cabinet shuffles since this initial prohibition was announced.
Yeah.
And Minister Blair brought this through very quickly, of course, after the Nova Scotia incident. And they didn't consult with industry or kind of understand what they were getting into. And now there's two ministers and a large bureaucratic administration that's in charge with dealing with this prohibition, and it's proved to be much more difficult than everyone envisioned at the start.
No kidding. Well, we'll see what happens from here. Much more is mentioned, csaaa.org. Wes, thanks so much for joining us here today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
All the best. That is Wes Winkholz, president of the Canadian Sporting Arms and Ammunition Association, representing the hunting and sport shooting industry in Canada. So through this process, they're trying to help retailers navigate all of this because of how convoluted and confusing it all is. Especially, you know, as he mentioned, when it comes to a lot of these firearms are going to be caught up in this. They're usually not sold fully assembled. So you've got various parts and components that you got to sort through. And does it fall into the prohibition? Is it eligible for the buyback? And what happens if retailers aren't able to sort all of this out before this amnesty ends and all of a sudden they're in possession of prohibited weapons, which has all kinds of implications for them and their business? But at least on the retail side, as Wes says, it should be somewhat simpler, just given that these retailers documented all of their inventory. So it's known what they have and what they're in possession of. But just, you know, the confusing mixed messages from government, you know, the changing list of what's going to be prohibited and what isn't, all of this has made it, at least the component of this that should be straightforward enough, that's a mess. Now think about how difficult it's going to be when it comes around to individuals and the buyback program. So again, we're into the billions of dollars for this. And again, to what end? What are we going to have to show for this at the end of the day in terms of any kind of measurable improvement in public safety? You think about what $2 billion could do if we really wanted to improve public safety. This wouldn't be the way to do it. This wouldn't be an area where you'd be spending a dime of that money. And who knows how much it's going to cost before all is said and done, or whether the amnesty is going to have to be, you know, postponed again, extended again. And who's going to do this? I mean, that part we don't even know. Like, we still have no idea how this is going to work. So law-abiding firearms owners, we're just trying to follow the law, do the right thing. They're confused. They're frustrated, understandably so.
Kurt Loder with an MTV News special report on a very sad day. Kurt Cobain, the leader of one of rock's most gifted and promising bands, Nirvana, is dead. And this is the story as we know it so far. Cobain's body was found in a house in Seattle on Friday morning. He was dead of an apparently self-inflicted shotgun blast to the head. Police found what is said to be a suicide note at the scene, but have not yet divulged its contents. Cobain, who was 27, had reportedly been missing for about 6 days, according to his mother.
So that was the news that landed 30 years ago yesterday. Pretty shocking news at the time. Kurt Cobain, lead singer of Nirvana, which had exploded onto the scene a couple of years earlier, was all of a sudden gone. This band that in so many ways actually came to define, you know, not just that period, but the 90s as a decade. It was an enormous loss, and I think as we've seen over the years, just how impactful that band was, it is underscored. You know, just how big that news was. And certainly as we've seen with other celebrity deaths, and maybe just their inability to just kind of come to terms with that, it can lead down the path of conspiracy theories, that maybe there's a different explanation. Maybe the quote-unquote official story isn't the actual story. And so not long after Kurt Cobain died, you started to see a lot of this emerge, and I guess as, you know, the internet started to emerge around the same time, it became easier to advance those kinds of theories, most along the lines of him being murdered. and a lot of them involving his widow, Courtney Love, who was a big star at the time herself. Alan Cross, a music writer, broadcaster, historian, host of the ongoing History of New Music, has an interesting piece up at globalnews.ca. You can also find it at his website at journalofmusicalthings.com, looking at why these theories emerged, kind of going through some of them in detail, and explaining why they're wrong. That we know how Kurt Cobain died. He took his own life. Alan Cross joins us on the line here this afternoon. Alan, great to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
You know, it's interesting. You think about, you know, some of the you know, well-known figures who died in the 90s. You know, Princess Di is an obvious one. Tupac Shakur and, of course, Kurt Cobain. You know, the common thread through all of those is that, you know, this belief that, you know, the quote-unquote official story isn't the real story. How do you explain, or is it possible to explain this kind of broader phenomenon, first of all?
Yeah, I mean, people love their conspiracies, and when something inexplicable happens, people want a reason for that inexplicable thing, and they need to blame someone or something. So people will often go to great lengths to twist reality into a way that fits their personal narrative. It's like what we see today with so many people Googling a particular subject until they find someone somewhere that agrees with how they feel. And with Kurt, yeah, that happened quite a bit.
You know, he was clearly troubled, right, in a lot of different ways. And, you know, without going through all of it, you know, I'm not sure why it seems so wildly implausible to people that he might have taken his own life. Why do you think this narrative emerged?
Well, one of the people involved was Tom Grant, a detective who was hired by Courtney Love to track down Kurt when he escaped from a recovery center in Los Angeles. And he never managed to find Kurt, even though he searched the house and in and around Seattle while Kurt was, frankly, lying dead in the greenhouse in the backyard. So he may have some reasons to perpetuate this idea that it was a murder. Now, he has an autopsy that says that Kurt had so many drugs in his system at such a high level that there was no way that he could have loaded and aimed the gun and pulled the trigger. There are other people who say that a hit was taken out on him. Other people are talking about things like retribution for Nirvana refusing to headline the 1994 Lollapalooza tour. People who were looking to punish Kurt or take him out because he was going to break up Nirvana and cost an awful lot of people an awful lot of money. Well, you know, none of those things really hold any water. They're all speculation.
Yeah.
And the big one I point people to is this idea that he had too many drugs in the system to pull the trigger. On the surface, that does seem true because the coroner's report, which wasn't entirely released under Seattle law and still hasn't been released, but a preliminary toxicology report reported of 1.52 milligrams of heroin per liter in his blood, which is a lot. And if you look at that, there, it's you would come to the conclusion that yes, he injected himself with a fatal dose of heroin and could not possibly have shot himself. Well, there's a problem with that because there are two types of tests involving this type of toxicology. There's one called a free morphine test and a total morphine test. And the total morphine test is one that is cheaper, faster, and more expeditious when it comes to dealing with somebody who is a known drug user. And what it does is it simply says that this drug user has a large buildup of morphine, which is what heroin turns into when you inject it, in his system. Now, Kurt was a very long-time drug user and heroin user. So if he had this, if the coroner had taken this total morphine test and determined that it was 1.52 milligrams per liter in his blood, well, that's not surprising because this is stuff that's been in his blood for months and months and months and months.
Right.
If the coroner had decided to do a free morphine test, that would have determined the amount of morphine in his bloodstream at that time. and 1.52 milligrams per liter would have been completely fatal, because that's what was in his system and operating at that time. Now, we don't know which test the coroner made, but it was most likely the total morphine test.
There's kind of a contradiction in all that, too, and you talk about it in your piece, you know, these theories that someone wanted him dead, that this was a murder made to look like a suicide. So they pumped him full of all of these drugs, and they shot him and made it look like he shot himself. Why go through the trouble of doing both then?
Well, that's it. It doesn't make any sense. Why not just, inject him with a fatal dose of heroin, which he had on hand, and be done with it? The people who are into this whole Courtney Love was involved situation forget that a month earlier, Kurt attempted suicide in Rome with an overdose of prescription pills. And it was Courtney who called the ambulance and saved his life. If she really wanted him dead, just let him die then. And they were actually getting along very well at the time, because while they were in Rome on this little vacation, he went out and bought her some lingerie and bought her some jewelry and a bunch of other things. So they were getting along fine. None of this makes sense.
Yeah.
None of the suicide, none of the murder stuff makes any sense. It's all just massive conjecture. And, you know, Dave Grohl thinks he committed suicide. Chris Novoselic thinks he committed suicide. The managers I've talked to think he committed suicide. His mom thinks he committed suicide. His father thinks he committed suicide. So if those people, the people closest to him, aren't screaming for a reopening of the murder investigation, that'll tell you something, too. In 2014, a cold case detective reopened the case and looked at it and went through a whole bunch of forensics, including examinations of the death scene and the gun and all the rest of it. Couldn't find anything. Agreed with the original coroner's report that it was suicide. And then in 2021 or two, recently anyway, the FBI released their report on Kurt Cobain's death. It was all of 10 pages long, and two of those pages were letters from fans asking them to reopen the case. And in all their findings, it was death by suicide.
Courtney Love, of course, who was married to Kurt Cobain, was a successful musician herself. She becomes a central figure in so many of these theories, and in weirdly different ways. Like you alluded to it earlier, the idea that she wanted Kurt all to herself so she could make all this money, and someone had to intervene to stop that. And then, of course, the other side of it is that she wanted him dead and was the one who orchestrated his murder. But in both instances, she's portrayed as this real scheming, sinister figure. Where did that come from?
We're dealing with two big personalities who make outrageous statements that were quite polarizing in the general public and the press. So she was looked upon as a Lady Macbeth by so many people. I can tell you that having spent a significant amount of private time, one-on-one time with Courtney over the years, there is no way. I mean, I've been to her house. There is no way she had anything to do with his death. Zero. I'll go to my grave saying that. You could dispute me if you want. Anybody can dispute me, but I know what I saw. I know what I feel.
It is almost curious in a weird way. I mentioned Tupac Shakur. I mean, you could even point to Elvis Presley or other celebrities that have died. And people kind of find it hard to accept that they're gone. And you get into these theories that they're not really dead. They've faked their death. They've gone off somewhere. They're in hiding. They're living under a new identity. For whatever reason, we never saw those kinds of theories. For all the theories out there about Kurt Cobain's death, I don't ever remember seeing that one.
Ah, there was one. He was either in Brazil or Peru performing under a new name. And as evidence, the internet found a picture of this guy who looks vaguely like Kurt and said that, no, that's him. He's hiding in Brazil. He's hiding in South America.
Well, there you go.
Not true. Not true.
I think all of this speaks to, and even to this day, the fascination with Kurt Cobain, what could have been maybe if he'd survived, just the colossal impact that band had. I mean, it really does speak to that legacy, doesn't it?
It does. This is a group that has not been around since 1994, so they broke up 30 years ago with Kurt's death. But people are still enamored with the band's music because it's that good and it's that that timeless, and Kurt was that strong of a songwriter and that strong of a singer and guitar player. It is, I find it fascinating about how life has changed for music consumption. If we go back to 1991, let's pretend we're 15 years old. There is no way we would be caught dead listening to music that's 30 years old. But here today, a 15-year-old can listen to Nirvana and Nevermind from, 33 years almost now.
Yeah.
And it's still good. It's still fine. It still has relevance. It still has authenticity. Tells you something about the music of the 90s.
Certainly does. Well, your latest is mentioned. It's up at globalnews.ca. Much more at ajournalofmusicalthings.com. Alan, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for making some time for us here today.
You're welcome.
Here you go. Alan Cross, music writer, broadcaster, historian. Some thoughts on Kurt Cobain, his legacy, his impact, his death, and some of the conspiracy theories that emerged along the way. Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.